A very good evening to you all, and this is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impuga. This evening we'll talk about electoral fraud in Africa. And with us tonight is my colleague, Henok Fente of VOA's Horn Service. Henok, welcome to the show once again.
Thank you, Douglas. Hello, Africa.
And we also have online Suleiman Mugula. He's a regular panelist and is an independent political analyst. He joins us as usual from Durban, South Africa. Good evening, Suleiman.
Good evening, Douglas. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're very much welcome. Gentlemen, once again, welcome to Reporters Roundtable. As I said, our topic tonight is electoral fraud. And electoral fraud or vote rigging is the illegal interference with the process of an election. Acts of fraud affect vote counts to bring about an election result, whether by increasing the vote share of the favored candidate, depressing the vote share of the rival candidates, or in some cases, both. Now, what constitutes electoral fraud under law varies from country to country. Let me start here in studio with that brief introduction of our topic. Henok, Africa is a mishmash of elections that are tend to be a bit fair, free and fair, but on the whole, most of the recent elections have been, people have described them as electoral frauds.
I like the use of the term electoral fraud. That's very diplomatic, I guess. Aside from being a reporter, you're showing us your diplomatic skills. But yes. In real street term, this is theft of people's voice, voices and their ability to form their own government. So I look at it in two ways. So there's two types of thieves when it comes to elections.
Mm-hmm.
There's those that stuff ballots.
Yes.
These are the beginners, the rookies. And there's the professional thieves who rig an election months,
or
in some
years.
Cases even years ahead of the election. So we can talk about some of the systems and mechanisms, but it boils down to two things. Professional thieves and amateur
those
thieves.
Those who are learning.
That's what we have.
Suleiman, does that go with the, depending on which incumbent or leader who has had power for a long time and therefore mastered the art of that, of what they call theft of votes?
Yes, precisely true. Those who have stayed in power, they have now perfected the whole process and they have put all possible firewalls in every system. They have got administrative firewalls, they have got legal firewalls, they have got security firewalls. So everything is choreographed very well so that everything looks as if everything is perfect, but when actually the whole process is rigged, the whole process is a facade.
Yes. Henok, going now to the specifics. Take, for instance, the recent election in Gabon. It was rocked by violence following the contested re-election of President Ali Bongo. The opposition leader, Jean Ping, declared himself the rightful president, and many people seemed to agree with him. You recall a few months ago, a similar incident happened in Uganda where the opposition candidate allegedly claimed he had won. He also declared himself
president.
He had his own swearing ceremony. So is this a sign that people are seeing through the so-called theft, or what does that show?
Well, people live through the theft, and people also understand in some cases where they are forced to vote for a party that has stayed in power for a long time. And there's reasons for that. People understand it, and they also participate in the process. Or, for use of a better term, they are forced to participate because there's no other option. So I think there's this kind of dictatorial regimes that stay in power for a long time use different mechanisms to rig elections. One of them is sort of use of economic incentives and financial incentives, acquiring land, having access to credit, which is vital for small and medium businesses. It all depends on your allegiance and your vote and your commitment to a ruling party. So this is one mechanism. Of course, there is the use of state resources to make sure that the opposition is crippled. Now, I can tell you about in most African countries going through elections, there is variations in the techniques, in the way they execute these techniques, but mostly the methods are all too similar. In Ethiopia last year, I went to cover an election where the ruling party won 100% of the votes. 100%. Now, these are 547 parliamentary seats,
yes.
And the ruling party controls
all of them.
Now, in some cases, this may seem maybe the ruling party won 60% of the votes and, you know, an opposition candidate won 40%. No, actually, in some districts where, you know, the prime minister or any other low-level, you know, government official ran for parliament, the opposition would get one. There would be four or five opposition candidates getting only one vote. Probably their wives or brothers and sisters did not vote for them. And the ruling party just taking the whole thing in a landslide. And people understand why these things happen. And people also understand how and why they're forced to participate in this kind of rigged systems. The case in Ethiopia was they had this Maoist organization where one person out of five is a member of the ruling party, and that person is tasked with providing information and also spying on those group of five people to the government up and down. So there's a flow of information using this human network. The Chinese used it during Mao's era, perfected it, and they still use it. And this has been adopted in Uganda also, in many other African countries. So similar techniques, but with variations of some locally adjusted executions.
Yes, but there are those who despite the techniques, some of them are on the edge, not purely criminal, but on the edge. But in some other cases, it's you get the opposition, arrest the opposition, beat, kill, use government resources. Suleiman, that one, I think, according to most analysts, borders on the criminal.
Yeah, I think there are two issues here. Number one, there is the increasing number of countries where the states have been captured. It is the latest trend on the continent. We have got state capture. Down here in South Africa, we are at the moment engulfed in a very big debate of an attempt by a small group to capture the state institution. Now, in most of these African countries, especially where the leaders have stayed for long, a small group captured the state a long time ago. Now, that is point number one. Point number two is that in most of these states, there has been a fusion between, the government and the ruling party. There is no difference. So you find that the government and the ruling government and the ruling party are the same. The security institutions work, which are supposed to be public institutions, are party institutions. The electoral commission, which is supposed to be serving everybody in the multi-party system, is serving the party in power as a priority. All the electoral officials up to the grassroots levels, they are answerable to the party, and they are, many of them are party members of the ruling party. The security forces are answerable to the political party and to the government. So there is no difference. So you find that in many of these countries, actually, it is an uphill an appeal case for the opposition because they are not contesting against other the incumbent. They are contesting against the government,
mm-hmm.
which makes it very, very, very difficult to make an inroad through them. These are cases like Uganda. Uganda, there is no difference between the political parties and the government.
Mm-hmm.
And everything, the state has been captured by a small group who own. Actually, the country is like it is owned by a small group of people who run everything, who have owned all the money, who control the security forces, who appoint electoral commissions, who appoint judges, just a small clique of people.
I see. But Tenok, in recent elections, for instance, in some countries, take Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Benin, Burkina Faso, Cape Verde, Senegal, there have been no disputes after elections. So it's not all lost on the continent, but a big number of countries,
a big chunk actually,
seems to have thrown all. Suleiman mentions the issue of all institutions merging into the political party or the ruling class or the ruling elite, controlling everything, electoral commissions, the security, the police, the judiciary, up to the bottom. So can Africa go ahead with having two dissimilar processes as far as elections are concerned?
Well, we do have about 12 or 13... elected democracies in Africa, and there has been significant progress when you compare it to what things were in the early 90s. But there's also some countries the fear that they're going two steps forward and one step back or vice versa. So it's there's progress, but then there's also hindrances in the process. I liked what Suleiman was talking about when he talked about the state and the ruling party also and becoming one. Even the people in government, people in politics in many African countries, they don't even pretend that these two institutions are different.
Before not cutting you off, in the recent election in Uganda, the chairman of the Electoral Commission said publicly that if he had his way, he would not nominate the opposition candidate. So
there you have
making his case very
right.
clear.
Last May in Ethiopia, in southern Ethiopia, where the leader of the main opposition party was running, we were being followed by this guy who was also coordinating the votes for the ruling party. And we got to know him and started having coffee with him because he's following us wherever we go. And also he had tremendous resources at his disposal, including vehicles that he was using that were state vehicles, offices. He was using a clinic as his base, and I asked him what he does, and he's the head of the education bureau. This was a time that students were taking national examinations, and I asked him, so shouldn't you be focused on making sure that exams are administrated? He said, this is far more important than the work that I do on a day in day out basis, because the only reason we have a job is because of this ruling party. So this just clearly shows you how they're not even apologizing about the fact that the two systems are not separate.
Well, for those joining us right now, we are listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we are coming to you live from the VOA studios here in Washington. And tonight we are discussing electoral fraud in Africa. Our panelists are Henok Fente, my colleague here of VOA Home Service, and Suleiman Mugula, a South African-based independent political analyst. And I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, here in Studio 9. Suleiman, with the advent of social media and allegedly civil society getting enlightened and educated about the electoral process, why hasn't this caused a dent on this theft or fraud?
In a few countries it has, and it is even worrying the ruling elite, because they are very big inroads. For example, in Uganda, there has been a disconnect between the voters and the government rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
The actual thing is that, for example, in Uganda, people seem to be enlightened, and they went and voted out Museveni. The truth of the matter is that much as the rigging was there, systematic one, but the people turned out in numbers and they were able to overwhelm the numbers which were being concocted.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, in Uganda, you'll find that there were parallel elections of both members of parliament and the presidents. You'll find that because the government rigging machinery concentrated very much on saving the president, it forgot to save many members of parliament. As a result, you'll find that many areas, the ruling party, very heavy, very big supporters of Museveni, were humiliatingly defeated, because the people were able to overrun, to overwhelm the rigging system. All that one is because of the mobilization through social media, the enlightenment through civil society. They were able to mobilize the people to go and force a change. And I think they did indeed change it.
In Uganda, they did succeed, but against hardship, because the government, you remember, shut down all the social media during the election.
It shut them down because after realizing that people had voted their own government in power, they feared mobilization for an insurrection.
Oh, I see.
Mobilization for demonstration. So they had to shut them down. The same also has happened in Gabon. Even in Gabon, much as they were ready to rig the election, still through the civil society, through mobilization, through enlightenment, people are able to almost overwhelm the system. Again, even in Gabon, the same thing has happened. Social media has had to be closed for about 3 days. Some radio stations, independent radio stations, have had to be closed. So Gabon is almost a replica of what happened in Uganda. Because even in concocting of results, like in Uganda, the place where President Museveni comes, it was 100%. The place where Bongo comes from is
hometown.
Is the ancestral area also 100%. All those questions are almost the same. Now it is becoming a norm in many of these African countries. But what is so interesting is that the voters are becoming more and more enlightened, more and more determined to overwhelm the system.
Henok, you agree that the social media and civil society organizations are trying their best?
They are, like Suleiman said, governments are also crippling this in institutions, shutting down media, shutting down the internet, because the digital sphere is very important, especially to organize young people, and this is their space. People who stayed in power, who are in their 60s or 70s, they can understand it, but they have a hard time communicating to a younger demography through social media. So best way is just shut down the internet. That's not the only thing, though. There is also legislative repression. We know what happened in Rwanda. Same is about to happen in Congo. President Kabila is going to have a third term. The courts are involved and everything, but also, which also brings us to crippling institutions, the courts being controlled by a person, a party. So it makes it really difficult for civil society or youth activism to actually bring about meaningful change when the institutions are crippled. The electoral commissions like you said, in many places. This is the first thing that opposition parties want to negotiate with governments. You know, when a repressive regime calls for the opposition to come to the palaces once in a while, and you know, they open the door for conversations. First thing that opposition party members raises, can we have an electoral body that's not appointed by you? Can we discuss the means and the mechanism that including funding, that this public institution can be independent? That's the first thing that they talk about. It hasn't been happening. And we've talked about the media and the courts.
Some observers and analysts have pointed out that the danger, though, with crippling institutions is that after a period of time, some of these countries actually will collapse. They will collapse with their leader. I mean, when the leader goes, because there are no institutions built to outlive that particular leader or that party, when he goes or the party collapses, the whole country goes down with him. Is that a real danger, Suleiman?
It is the biggest danger. That is why we have continued to shout as much as possible, because our biggest fear is that with the collapse of these regimes, you will have instability, and there is a likelihood that these countries will collapse the way it happened in Somalia, the way it happened in Libya. So I think every country where people have institutionalized a clique of people governing over people, and the way my brother has said, remember, we're having a young continent.
Yeah.
We cannot rule out what happened in Burkina Faso. When they overrun it, they almost destroy everything. Mm-hmm. It is so costly for these leaders to continue staying in power. Look at the destruction that has been done in Gabon. Look at the destruction in Burundi. How many people are running out of the country? Look at the destruction in southern Sudan. It is affecting the whole area. At the moment, as we speak, in Burundi, there is a vacuum. In southern Sudan, there is a vacuum. In Zanzibar, there is a vacuum. In Gabon, there is a vacuum. In Uganda, they are pretending they are going on, but actually there is a vacuum. There is contested election because the opposition leader still insists that he won the election, and he has got evidence that he won the election. And even you can feel from the people when you walk on the street that people know that this is an illegitimate government.
Mm-hmm.
So the day they overrun it, the anger of these young people, they are capable of destroying almost everything which has done for the past 30 years.
What I will say is that, you know, these governments have started to believe their own lies. They actually think that they're a legitimate government elected by the people. And it's like a movie where you have a bunch of thieves or robbers. They go and lock out in a bank robbery, right? So what happens is they start going at each other, or they start leaving tips to the police to capture them because they start to get comfortable. A year ago in Ethiopia, people voted the current ruling party 100%. Now Ethiopia is having a lot of protests in two of the most important regions, the Amhara region and Oromia region. How does that happen? You know, people started to get, and even now the government is basically saying it's a problem of good governance, but a government that has this much discontent within its population. How did they amass those votes?
100%
is just it doesn't get better than that. So they get comfortable, and also the repression, as they get comfortable, becomes so much that people are rising up, and it's really dangerous when it's when there's no opposition, viable opposition, to stop any kind of dangerous movement that a country is going towards. So,
comfort aside, there are others who argue that actually it's more fear than comfort, that some of them have committed crimes.
It could be.
Some of them have been either unwilling or unable to provide social services to their people, no health services, no education, no nothing, so that they fear that if they leave power, they may be held to account. To what extent is that a factor in them sticking to power and using all possible ways to make sure they rig the elections? Suleiman, first.
Yeah, it is part of the reasons why they are kept in power. For example, when you look at all the dictators, people like Yahya Jammeh, they have massacred people. People in DRC, people are dying every day. In Uganda, you have got a leadership which had a civil war where you had almost 500, half a million people camped in concentration camps and dying like rats. You had a civil war before that one for about a couple of years, also killing people anyhow. Even after that coming in power, still you have got deaths here and there, and then he's involved in Sudan, he's involved in DRC, he's involved in Rwanda. So a leadership like that one has got a lot of blood on its hand. They cannot imagine, because they don't only have blood from within, they have got even transnational blood on their hands. So I think that one is also part of the reasons why they can't cede power to other people. But what is so amazing, the way my brother said that, it is very clear that many of them have already lost it. For example, in Uganda, because Uganda is a classic example, you have got a president who has been in power for 30 years, who claims he won with a big margin, but whose strongmen were all defeated, some in their own parties, some in the national election. You find that Museveni, right now, all the men whom he captured power with, many of those who tried to contest elections were defeated by ordinary people, others even defeated by comedians. To show how much the people are so angry. Mm-hmm. They would rather give a comedian than giving someone who is a supporter, who is a former minister, who has been a minister. I think they even deputed a deputy prime minister.
Yeah, they did.
And some of his minister of defense, minister of information, some of the guys whom we started with the organization and whom we have been with 30 years, to show you that he has no ground now as far as the populace is concerned. But he still masquerade as a person who is popularly elected. So there is a disconnect between the leadership, the way my brother said, they're in a comfort zone which is non-existent.
Henok, we have about 30 seconds left. Is there hope for these countries to change, and maybe for some of those leaders or the people power to force them to concede and leave power? Or maybe it's a hopeless case?
Just very quickly on the earlier point, it's not just very few powerful people in politics we're talking about facing justice. There is a system of patronage. They have made sure that they have co-opted the elite, so the elite doesn't organize the population. So now what we have is people who fear that they might face justice. These are the politicians. But most importantly, the elite who fear they might lose the economic gains that they have amassed because of the co-optation and the process of patronage that these governments have created. So it really becomes very difficult for people to engage in political activities because the organization is already rigged, organizing people to bring about change systematically.
The trouble with that at some point, then the only option is things just flare up. Because people make no distinction between, because as it's true, in some of these countries, the elite business class have merged with the government because their check comes from government. So it's difficult to segregate the two and have them.
And they will make sure that the disadvantage stays in, because that's the only way they have access to finance, access to land, access to everything, import, export, business licenses, and all of that. They don't want the governments to go.
Well, we're out of time. Otherwise, we shall continue with this discussion. That wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our panel, my colleague here, Henok Fente of VOA's Horn Service, and Suleiman Mugula, an independent political analyst based in South Africa. Gentlemen, once again, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Our producer was Jackson Mvunganyi, and our amiable engineer did a very good job too. I'll be back again with another edition of Reporters Roundtable next week. A reminder, you can listen to part of this to this program if you go to our main website at www.vonews.com. You can also drop us a line. Our email is reporters@vonews.com. Thanks very much for tuning in. And until next week, I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, wishing you all the best.